my gorgeous listeners, and welcome along to another episode of the Glow West podcast, where we talk about sex, sexuality, and the body through a sexual wellness perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline West, and I'm delighted to be part of the Tortoise Shack Network, and we're making awesome content, so off you go and check that out. Today, my guest is someone that I've been super excited to talk to for a while, because she just makes pretty things happen in the world, and we all need a little bit of that from time to time. So today I'm talking to Cora Harrington, and she's the founder and editor-in-chief of The Lingerie Addict, the world's leading lingerie magazine, as well as the editor of In Intimate Detail, How to Choose, Wear and Love Lingerie. She's also an internationally recognised expert in the area of intimate apparel, having been quoted in or written as a columnist for multiple publications such as the New York Times. Her mission is to make the intimidating world of lingerie accessible, understandable, and fun for people of all sizes, shapes, races, and gender identities. Cora is currently planning her second book, which is a more intensive deep dive into the lingerie industry. Cora, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really excited about doing this and that we could make the time across our time zone.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't work so well, but we got there. Tell me how you got involved in lingerie and also got so good at it.
So this is actually my second career. My first career was in nonprofits. I worked especially in crisis management, so working with people in crisis. And it was a very stressful job. Nobody ever calls a crisis hotline because they're having a good day. You never talk to people who are having a happy day or who are kind of at their best. And I wanted something that was completely different from that kind of work, something that gave me a chance to relax, that was low stakes. And that was just a way for me to see pretty things. And I was also dating someone at the time who I wanted to buy something nice for. And I couldn't find any information online about how to buy lingerie, what are good brands, how do you know your size, where should you shop from. There just wasn't much at all online. And so I started my site by just sharing stuff I thought was pretty. And it went from there. After a while, I started doing reviews, very bad reviews. They're not good.
Okay.
And my love and appreciation started from there, where the more I learned about lingerie, the more I was interested in it, the more I wanted to share, and the more other people were attracted to my point of view, because the perspective was very much on, these pieces are beautiful, what do you think of them? And less around, you need to look sexy for a heterosexual partner.
I think that's a really important part, because I think, like, I would have been guilty of that as well, of only viewing lingerie as something you buy for sex and for a man's appreciation or something like that. I took me the longest time, actually probably really until I read your book, to actually look at lingerie as something just fun and a form of self-care for yourself. And I love that you have that message in it, because that's rare. Like, I don't really recall a whole lot of other places where we have that message of treat yourself to lingerie just for yourself.
Well, I think part of making that world of intimate apparel more accessible, which is really something important to me, is creating a less intimidating entry point into it. Because if people feel like, well, I can only wear lingerie if I'm a woman, if I'm partnered, if I'm feeling sexy, those are a lot of barriers for people. And I think lingerie is already so intimidating. It's already, it already feels, I think, very uncomfortable for people, especially in America, because it is often associated with sex, that showing people there are lots of different kinds of lingerie. It's not just garter belts and thongs. It's also caftans and pajamas and all these other things. And telling people that this is a way to nurture yourself, to take care of yourself, and to center you primarily as the subject and not as the object of someone else's gaze is not a message that we get a lot. And I mean, I'm married. My husband cares absolutely nothing about lingerie. I'm doing this podcast like in a drapey, flowy caftan, because that's what makes me feel comfortable while I am stuck at home in my, 16-week of quarantine.
Yeah. I'm in my pajamas too, so I can't complain either.
And that was a message that resonated with me, and also that I felt was the most inclusive message. There are asexual people that read my site. There are non-binary people that read my site. There are unpartnered people that read my site. There are queer people that read my site. And I think that particular perspective is one that makes intimate apparel feel accessible to all of those people, and of course, more besides.
And I love that one of your main messages, you know, following on from that, is saying that you make the point that lingerie is often promoted as just being for very slim supermodel types. And if we look at, you know, the Victoria's Secret catalog, or, you know, their runway show when it was there, they were all like Glamazonian warriors, you know, like that they're not reflective of, like, you know, 90%+ of the population. And they also said, I think, that they wouldn't have trans people on. And I think their idea of plus size is a pretty average size. It's just, you know, one step off from like very, very slim kind of thing. Like why are they still kind of clinging on to that idea of these are the only people that should be wearing lingerie?
It's been very interesting watching the Victoria's Secret brand develop and looking at the history of the Victoria's Secret brand. It's so funny that we're talking about this, because I actually just watched the 2005 fashion show with my patrons, where we discussed how the brand has changed and has not changed in the last 15 years. I think Victoria's Secret and their stagnation is what happens when you have only two people in charge of a brand, Ed Razek, Les Wexner. And when they oriented the brand around what they like to see, and not to be crude, but around what turns them on, and they don't bother to actually stay connected with the population of lingerie buyers. They don't bother to stay connected with the trends. They don't care enough about or respect their customers enough to listen to them when their customers say what they want to see more of. And I won't say the Victoria's Secret is a tragic case, because it doesn't make sense to feel sorry for them. Like everything that's happening was brought onto themselves.
It's self-inflicted.
But it's so interesting to me that they went from the market leader in America. They went from the name on everyone's lips, myself included, because shopping at Victoria's Secret when I was in my 20s was a big deal, to a name people actively want to avoid. And so much of that is because they refuse to keep up with the shifts in the industry. They thought, because they were the market leader, that they were also the leader as far as aesthetics, or as far as what customers wanted. And they were so arrogant, unnecessarily arrogant, because, you know, they could have brought me in as a consultant and I would have told them.
Damn it. They missed an opportunity.
It's so wild, because I know they can attract some of the best talent in the world. They can attract the best consultants, the best MBAs, the best marketing and PR people. They had all these resources, but Ed Razek and Les Wexner, I think, were so arrogant that it never occurred to them that they weren't the leaders in as far as what people wanted to see anymore. I think they were both genuinely surprised. And as I said, when we were watching the show from 15 years ago, which was Tyra Banks' last show, the aesthetic of the long flowing hair extensions, the Glamazonian warriors, as you said, the high heels, the winks at the camera, was exactly the same as the last fashion show in 2018. Except that the production value is a lot worse nowadays.
So not much change at all, really.
No, but there's not much change at all. And so they got very attached to this one aesthetic and never bothered to do anything different. Oh, and when I went back to saying, like, it's not a tragic case, but it is just, I think, a bit sad and foolish, is that Victoria's Secret, in addition to having the resources to hire some of the best talent in the world, they had the resources to expand their sizes. They had the resources to bring on a plus size model. I mean, they could have, instead of being the brand where everybody's like, no, thank you, they could have been seen as the brand that mainstream plus sizes, that mainstream full bust cups, that had the first plus size angel. There were so many opportunities for them to show that they were listening to customers, right? That they were keeping up, that they were innovating. They had years to do that. People gave them the benefit of the doubt for years. And instead, you had the Ed Razek interview in Vogue where he said, no, we're not going to do any of that. And I think there was already a gradual decline, and that interview was the one that made people go, okay, we're done. Like, you don't care about us. You don't want to do anything. So we don't care about you. And then, of course, when the connection between Les Wexner and, now I can't remember his name. He was a guy who died in prison and who ran a sex ring, like a pedophile.
Oh, Jeffrey Epstein?
That guy. I don't know. I mean, I don't make a practice of remembering pedophiles' names. So maybe
that's wise.
When the relationship came out between Les Wexner and him as well, I think was another
Oh yeah, you don't want to support someone.
What
like
is
that.
The word I'm thinking of?
Nail
like
in
a
the
death
coffin.
Knell or another nail in the coffin, as it should be, because you should not associate with pedophiles and people who are in sex rings.
Yeah, 100%. Well, do you think like that's stubbornness as well to change? I mean, like that's in a lot of brands, you know, like that resistance to like reflect the realities of life, I suppose. I feel like the ground then was like primed for Rihanna to come along. Like I remember seeing her fashion show and just being just so shocked at the diversity, because I hadn't seen diversity on a runway like to that level, and you know, just like the different sizes that were there, the different, even the fabric looked nicer. I think like a lot of lingerie, like mainstream, looks very flammable looking. Like you don't want to get too close with a lighter or a candle. But I thought Rihanna just absolutely smashed that, and I think that she's one of the main reasons as well that they would have declined as well. Would you think you'd agree with that, or is that?
Well, I think Rihanna was definitely able to slide into the conversation about intimate apparel at the right time with the right message, which of course was no accident. And that she was able to take advantage of that longstanding gap in the way Victoria's Secret marketed their lingerie, but also in the way a lot of other brands market their lingerie. I think that tendency to be reluctant to change, to double down on what you've always done, to not pay attention to trends is something endemic to the intimate apparel industry. It's something I talk with brands about quite often, that you need to have models of color. You need to have models of different sizes. This thing where you're like, oh, dress like a French woman, and it's this slim, you know, gamine, white woman, is not going to be the campaign that resonates with people anymore. And so I think Rihanna was able to take advantage of that stagnation across the category and swoop in with something that said, I know what you want. Here is the answer. I heard you. I know what you're asking for. I know these other companies are giving it to you, but I will. And I think when it comes to kind of the idea of quality, what matters less is the actual quality of a brand, and what matters more is the perception of that quality. Most customers aren't going to necessarily note the differences in quality across brands, which is not their fault. Like, we don't grow up in a selling culture. Most of us are not going to spend a lot of time looking in detail at different kinds of bras.
Not usually.
I me and my writers do. So what I say is the actual quality of a company matters a lot less than what customers think that quality is. And so with Rihanna versus Victoria's Secret, people think Victoria's Secret is low quality. Doesn't matter how good the quality actually is. They've decided it's low quality. And with Rihanna, they've decided it's higher quality, irrespective of whatever, you know, an intimate apparel expert would say. And that's what matters most.
That's a really interesting point, because I know you've been to Ireland before, but you mightn't have had a chance to pop into a shop called Penny's that we have here.
I don't think so.
It's known internationally as Primark, so it's not JCPenney's.
It's not here. It's not in the States.
No, they moved to Boston. They're expanding. Yeah. But they have such cheap...
I have heard of them, though.
Yeah. They wear Irish. Predominantly Irish. They have such cheap underwear. Like, it's, you know, where you can get like five knickers for a fiver kind of thing, and, you know, a set for like maybe €10. And their pajamas are one of the biggest bestsellers. You know, like, that's where you go to get your pajamas. You don't, you know, a lot of people wouldn't go anywhere else. But that perception of Penny's, like, we know it's really cheap. We know the labor behind that might be sweatshop labor, and we know it's not going to last. But there's still that sense of like, this is what we buy. You know, they kind of have that market cornered of like, that's where you go to get your five pairs of underwear for a fiver kind of thing, even if you have to repetitively buy them every month. But that's, they don't spend money on advertising in that sense. That's just word of mouth and, you know, customer satisfaction with that. So, yeah.
I think the I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think the comparable thing here would be people going into Target and buying cheap underwear while they're in a Target, for example, or picking up underwear maybe while they're in Walmart. Target, more likely, because Target has more kind of like fashion-oriented branding than Walmart does. So I would say that's more so the equivalent here, especially, and that's also kind of while we're on this topic. I think people often forget when discussing market share and discussing the industry is that companies like Target buy a whole lot of underwear. So when we're talking about market leaders are talking about the largest brands, they're not always the brands with the biggest PR presence. Sometimes the biggest brands are going to be brands that fly under the radar or that don't really appear in industry news. Like, for example, Hanes, huge brand, is probably not going to be in an article about leading laundry industry brands, even though they sell a massive amount of underwear every year.
Okay, interesting. Well, and if, while we're on price, you know, it says, you know, in your book, you talk about underwear can vary between £5 and £500 as such. What are the different price points? And, you know, are you getting value for money at 500, you know, even euro or pound or dollars for, mm-hmm. for an outfit? Or is that reserved for, I don't know, like different classes of people, or just are they special occasion items, or, you know, what are we getting for our money in that sense?
Mm-hmm. So some of the differences you might see between what I would call an expensive bra or a cheap bra, we'll say it's like $20. A mid-price bra, which is going to be more like $60 to $75. And what I would call an expensive bra, which I think for most people is going to start around the $100 mark. With that cheaper bra, you're going to see a stretchier elastic. You might see more uncomfortable underwires. You're going to see that the fabrics don't have as nice of a finish as a more expensive bra. The laces, for example, won't be as nice. The embroideries won't be as nice. You might see plastic sliders or fasteners or things like that. Like the bra just isn't made to last. And most notably, those cheaper bras are not going to come in a whole lot of sizes. And that's part of why they're cheap, because we know that when you engineer a bra for a larger cup size, it takes more time and more money in every single way. And that's often why those bras are not available for $20. It's less of a grudge against Fuller Bus and more a side effect of that's what happens when you have a $20 bra. When you get into that mid-price point, which I like to call the sweet spot of lingerie, like I said, the kind of that $60, $75 price range, you're going to find lots of sizes. You're going to find a range of styles, a range of aesthetics. And I think most importantly for a lot of people, when those bras go on end-of-season sales for 50% off, they're going to become about as affordable as those cheaper bras, and you'll have more variety. Because no one cares if you wear a bra from last season. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. That's also you don't have to keep up things. With the Kardashians or
right,
anything on it.
Right, about yeah. lingerie. Like, it's fine if you get something from last season. So that's often what I recommend to people, where if you can't, that there's a noticeable shift in quality that matters to people. And you can also get those bras inexpensively when those fashion colorways or what have you are being switched over at the end of the season. You get into ultra expensive lingerie, for example, like you said, that $500 tier, clearly luxury products, clearly non-essential products. And what you're going to see are these really high level couture techniques. You're going to see these exquisite fabrics. That's the price point you're going to see, for example, a Chantilly lace from France. That's going to be the price point where you see massive swaths of silk. That's going to be a price point where you have lace applique with, you know, these little bitty tiny stitches. You're going to have heavyweight silks. You might have, you know, gold-plated fastenings and finishers. You might see things like a custom embroidery that's exclusive to that brand and limited edition. You're probably going to see some sexier silhouettes. I don't like this word, but what a lot of people will call sexy but classy. How a lot of people would describe lingerie at that price point. You're going to see maybe some more avant-garde garments. You might see some corsetry. So, and that's where things get a lot more creative. And I think a lot less concerned with function, where the goal is very much on crafting an experience as opposed to having that everyday garment, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'd all like to wear $500 bras every day and have that luxurious lifestyle. But yeah, unfortunately, a lot of us are in utilitarian territory. Where
yeah, well, and that's fine. I mean, wearing a $500 bra every day is it's probably not going to work for a lot of folks, because I mean, even for me, I have so much beautiful lingerie, which I know is very surprising, but it's difficult. It's hard even for me to pull out those more expensive pieces because I don't want to ruin them. I don't want to mess them up. And I'm personally trying to get a lot better about wearing my nicer things, more often. But I mean, for that everyday workhorse bra that you just need to throw in and not think about, that $60 to $75 price point is a good place for that, for the reasons I've mentioned before.
So if you know, we're buying the bra, talk to me about bra fitting, because that is one of the most frustrating experiences of my life. When you get a different fitting or a different measurement in one shop, you go into another shop, it's a different cup size or bust size. And then you've got Reddit communities, I think it's called A Bra That Fits, and they'll give you one size. And so it's just like, where do you start when you've got all those different measurements and numbers? And, you know, because you don't want to waste your money on bras that won't actually fit when you're finally in them. So is there a magic formula? Please say there is.
So the thing about those different sizes and fits that I just want to touch on before we get into potential ways of measuring is, I know they're very frustrating because it means, like you said, every brand you try or every shop you go into, it might fit a little different, which is very common. But without all those various permutations of size and fit, you would have a situation where nobody could find a bra that works for them, because if every bra fits exactly the same and that bra doesn't fit you, then that's it. You don't have any other bras to try.
That's a very good point.
So the fact that there are all these little variations, I know it's frustrating because it means you have to try more on, but there is more to try on. I think sometimes people, when they say every bra should fit the same, just perhaps kind of assume that bra is going to fit them. But if it doesn't and every bra fits the same, then what are you going to do? So I always like to remind people of that there are reasons why every brand cuts a little different, styles a little different. And that's because all of our breasts are a little bit different. If you have full-on bottom breasts, you're not going to want the same shape as somebody with full-on top breasts. So we have to have all those variations. When it comes to bra fit methods, there are various and competing schools of thought that some people feel very, very passionate about.
I can imagine.
what I think of as, so first of all, you always want to check the size chart for the brand that you're buying from, because there's this idea that that some people have in certain communities, that every brand kind of cuts their bras exactly the same or uses the exact same size chart. That is absolutely not true. You'll be very, very frustrated if you go by that advice. For example, a bra that you might buy from a brand at Walmart that uses traditional plus four sizing, if you decide to ignore that and use a plus zero method, that bra is not going to fit you. And it's not the bra's fault. Like, they told you how to fit yourself for that bra.
The instructions were there.
So look at the size chart. A way to start, though, that, and like I said, this is just a starting point, because the other thing is you can't avoid trying on bras. Like, there's no shortcut to that. You have to, I think more than any other garment, you have to get it on your body to see if it works for you. So again, frustrating, but not really a way around it. A good starting point is you want to measure around your rib cage, which is going to be for most people kind of just under where their breast meets their chest. And that's going to be your band measurement or your starting point for your band measurement. And then you want to go up to your breasts at their fullest point, which is going to be about nipple height. If your breasts are more pendulous, or if you have softer breast tissue, you might need to lean forward to get that measurement, because your nipples might not be projecting outwards. They might be projecting downwards. So that's something to keep in mind. And then you subtract one measurement from the other. You subtract the band size from the nipple height size from the cup size, and the number of inches that are different. I don't know what this would equal in the UK, because you all use centimeters and we use inches.
Yeah. No, we're inches okay. In Ireland. Yeah. I had to think about that for a second. Yeah,
right, inches. So I feel like America's weird in that. We're like, inches and feet. And other people are like, what are you doing? Yeah. Anyway, back to what I was saying.
I think in France and stuff, they use centimeters, I think, in mainland Europe. Okay. Yeah. Okay. There we go.
you subtract the band size from that nipple height size. And for every inch of difference, that is another cup size. So 1 inch of difference A, 2 inches of difference B, 3 inches of difference C, D, so forth and so on. Where it gets tricky is when you go beyond the D cup and you'll see that every country every country we're familiar with when it comes to bras, Australia, countries in the EU, France, Belgium, etc., countries in the UK, and countries in the US will all have slightly differing size charts as far as what those letters are beyond a D cup. And that's where you'll want to do like a cross comparison cup size chart, which I have one in the back of my book. There are some available online so that you can make sure that if you have 5 inches of difference, for example, and which would be an E cup, is another brand going to call that a double D cup instead of an E, for example. That's where you'll get into needing those other size charts.
It's just, I wish this was taught a lot more, or like, you know, had a lot more conversations for people starting out with wearing bras. And because I think a lot of people wear the wrong size bra, and then you're kind of carrying that on through your life sometimes.
Well, I don't like to say things like wrong sizes, but I like to say like maybe you're not wearing like the optimal fit or a bra that would make you feel the best. Okay. I think especially in America, it can be more difficult to access those sizes beyond a double D cup, beyond a triple D cup. And I think a lot of people do know that the bras they're wearing are uncomfortable and are not their best fit. But if that's all they can access, I don't know from my perspective what comes out of saying, well, that's the wrong bra size and you shouldn't wear that, because if that's all you can access, it's all you can access. So I try to be, when we're having these conversations around size and fit, to keep in mind people's circumstances and not shaming people. And just keeping in mind that our access is very different. And perhaps that's especially true in America because the country is so daggone big where you might not have access to a boutique that sells a K-cup, for example. I grew up, you can tell if I'm rambling.
It's okay. No, it's fascinating.
I grew up in a town that was 100 miles from the nearest lingerie boutique, still does not have a lingerie boutique to this day. Nobody's driving 100 miles to get a bra fitting.
Yeah, very true.
From a shop.
Yeah, you're going to just go to whatever's nearby and that's it.
Yeah, you're just going to go to whatever's nearby, which is probably going to be the Target or the Victoria's Secret. And that's just what you have access to. And so I think when we're having this conversation on size and on fit, acknowledging that, acknowledging the access portion, and acknowledging that frustration is important. And then also remembering, I'm a big advocate for buying online. I think that's where people are going to find the most options, the most sizes, the most ways to try things on. But I also know you have to acknowledge that everybody doesn't have the money to have a steady stream of bras kind of coming in and out and waiting for refunds while they're finding that perfect size. And that also in America, a lot of people are unbanked. They don't have a debit card. They don't have a credit card. They don't have a way to purchase online. And so having these conversations that give people advice and information, but also doesn't shame them for a lack of access, I think is very important and can be a fine line to tread, especially if you're passionate. But if people feel shamed by the conversation around bras, you know, they're definitely not going to find their optimal size. And if the goal is to help people, then that's something you have to navigate. That was a very long rambling answer.
No, but it's so true. But it's such a good point, because like we talk a lot, you know, well, I talk a lot about like period of poverty and stuff like that. But I suppose I never applied that really to like bra poverty, you know. And yeah, so that's I'm really glad that you've brought that up, because it's something that maybe a lot of us don't really consider. And I think that accessibility issue is huge. Like if you look at like trans people and they're trying to buy bras, you know, for if you're not trying to buy a binder, or you know, if you're new to having breasts, like, you know, that can be quite difficult, I'm sure, for a lot of people to even get the guts to go into a lingerie shop and risk like rejection or whatever. And that's
transphobia. The industry has not always been very inclusive. That's something that I talk about often. There are boutiques that are actively hostile to trans people, and suggesting a boutique for someone who has to worry about shame or even violence, that's not a solution.
No.
And so I would also appreciate if the lingerie industry, rather than making the conversation all about boutiques, go into a boutique. I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons why that's not an option for people. And we need to meet people where they are when we're discussing lingerie and when we're discussing bras, which 100%. Might not be where you want them to be. I don't know, but you got to come to where people are.
Yeah, No, absolutely. You know, you're so right in that. I'll probably tell you something now that might horrify you, but I remember watching a TV show in my teenage years, and I think it was like a hoarder show. No, it was actually How Clean Is Your House? Do you remember that show where they go in and put their hands in your toilet and stuff? But the person's
house... No, I've never seen it.
No? Oh, it's gross. You're not missing much. They literally put their hands in the toilet and go, oh, look how dirty it is. And you're like, you didn't need to put your bare hands on the toilet to find that out.
Nope, not for me.
No. But the woman who had been on it... Now, obviously, I think there's a lot of, like, you know, mental illness and issues going on if your house is, you know, so bad like that. But she'd worn the same bra for a year straight.
Oh, and no.
You just think, like, there's a lot of, like, risk of infection and stuff like that. So that's obviously the extreme end. But how often should we be washing our bras? Should it be everywhere? Should it be once a week, once a month, or once a year for that lady?
Oh, no, definitely not that. So it varies. I'm always reluctant. This is one thing I say in my book, to give too many hard and fast rules. I would say you want to wash at least every few wears. You shouldn't be wearing your bra like 10 times in a row before you wash it. If you sweat a lot, that might look like wearing your bra after every wear. Sports bras, definitely wash after every wear, because you don't want to get an infection or have issues. If you don't sweat a lot, for example, it's the winter, you might wash your bra every 3 to 4 wears. Some people are like, no, you got to wash it after every single wear. And if that's what works for you, then fine. For some people who might have eczema or something, it has to happen after every single wear. But I think you should kind of gauge your lifestyle and see what works best for you. So like right now, it's really hot outside. I might change my bra like twice in a day. Obviously, I have a lot of bras, so I can do that.
Yeah.
But like I don't like wearing like sweaty bras. They really irritate my skin. And I'm not going to put a bra back on that has gotten sweaty because now it's dirty. And so like this time of year when it's so warm outside, I prefer to wash my bras after every wear. In the winter, I'm not going outside as much, probably not wearing a bra as often. Definitely not sweating because it's freezing. I might go like a few wears before I wash that bra. That's kind of my suggestion. Underwear, obviously, wash after everywhere. Doesn't apply to underwear. Yeah. But I do think with bras, there is some flexibility. And again, part of that is about making it more accessible and not intimidating people. Because we know for a fact, everybody's not washing their bras after every single wear. So what can you tell people that is something that they would do? And I think washing after everywhere in the summer, when it's hot, when you're sweating, when it's less sweaty and you're not going out as much, you can go a little longer between washes. I hope makes people feel like it's a little more accessible and reasonable. I mean, when it comes to washing, I'm like, you can wash it in the shower, like rinse it out in the shower, hang it up, like throw it in the sink. It also doesn't have to be this long, complicated process. I think pulling out the wash basin and pulling out the lingerie wash and chilling and scrubbing with your bras is something I do. But also I'm me.
Yeah. So, I was going to say that a lot of the rest of us don't have time for that. But yeah.
Right. So if what works for you, like you get home from a run, you're wearing a sports bra, take it off, like wash it in the shower with you. Whatever works for you that's where you start. And if you want to make things more complicated later, once that feels more comfortable to you, well, then you can do that. But what counts is getting that start.
I like as well in your book when you are talking about different kinds of underwear and how changing bodies need to access different types of underwear. So you're talking about why we need different underwear when we're going through menopause, or for trans people who might have issues with external genitalia. So can you talk us through a little bit about those changes that we need to be reflective of when it comes to different underwear? And I'm just really glad that like you included that in it, because I wouldn't have thought half those issues were there, you know, before I kind of had access to people like yourself. I didn't think about different underwear for different life stages. You know, it's either utility or sex. That was pretty much it back in the day. So, I'm really glad you're putting that content out there. But yeah, so different life cycles. Where are we with that?
As far as the content in the book, that was also part of the accessibility thing, where I wanted as much as I could within the limitations of a book to make it as accessible as possible, where if you picked it up, you could hope for or kind of feel the likelihood that there would be something in there specifically for you. That's also why my book doesn't use gendered pronouns. It's a gender neutral text.
Yeah, I love
for that,
that
same reason. So I feel like when we're talking about laundry, we're talking about intimate apparel. Part of that conversation is recognizing that everyone is going to be a cis straight woman. So how do you have that conversation if someone is masculine of center, if they're a trans man, they have breasts, they might be feeling dysphoric about those breasts. They may not want to wear a bra. They might, before they can get gender confirmation surgery or breast removal for their chest. So how do you have that conversation about bras and binders for someone who would prefer to not have to wear a bra at all? Or when you're talking about people who are feminine of center, non-binary feminine of center, trans women, how do you have that conversation about wearing bras for your developing breasts or finding underwear that has more room while still being safe? And I think that's also the other part, is discussing this in a way where people can feel safe about trying their options. Because if you're growing up in rural Iowa or something, you might not be able to safely access a binder, or you might not know what binder you can buy, but at least you'll know not to bind with an ACE bandage. At least you know that, that's a harmful option, so maybe I should do something else. Or if you're a trans woman, it may not be safe for you to wear underwear, or you might not know where to start. So, then you'll know that maybe a bralette, or maybe you don't want to spend a lot on lingerie just yet because your body's changing. So, you would know, maybe a bralette is where I should start because there's more room there to accommodate my chest as it's growing. And it's also better able to accommodate, a smaller chest. And so a lot of what went into that was, if people can't access this information easily or readily, at least there's a place for them to get started. Because I won't say that my book, does a comprehensive treatment of binders or of lingerie for trans feminine people, but at least it's a place to start. And thinking the same way about when you're recommending lingerie for pregnancy, for menopause, for breast surgery, it's also comes from that point of view. There are people who are disabled, who don't have, good use of their arms and hands, who still need to wear bras. There are people who just had breast surgery who still need to wear bras. And so how can you kick off that conversation to, at the very least, give them a place to start before perhaps they're able to do more research on their own or access more information on their own? Does that answer your question?
It does. And it's an interesting question for or topic for design as well. Things like if you have a front clasp on a bra or a side clasp or a back, and how does a person with a disability, and has issues maybe using hands or reaching around to a back fastener? That's an interesting, thing that I don't think a lot of manufacturers maybe would necessarily think of, because if they're only marketing towards able-bodied cis women, they're not going to take into all those different considerations into account. So,
right. And it often, that innovation comes from those smaller brands. There's a brand called Slick Chicks that we reviewed pretty recently on the site that makes accessible underwear that you can hook and unhook from the side, as opposed to slipping up and down your legs.
I've seen this. So, that looks amazing.
Right.
And so simple, so effective.
Yeah, and it's something that did not come from the mainstream intimate apparel industry. That came from an independent designer who saw a gap in the market and decided to fill it. So if you're in a wheelchair, or you're pregnant, for example, and maybe pulling underwear up and down is just not a possibility, now you have this option that didn't exist before. And I think, we absolutely need to have more of those conversations. I'm an able-bodied person. I don't, insofar as I don't have mobility limitations. And so there are going to be a lot of things that I personally don't notice. And that's why I think the intimate apparel industry should actively seek out those diverse viewpoints. Because you need other people. Other people need, I don't want to phrase this. People from those communities will tell you what they need if you ask them and if they're included in the conversation.
I think you've raised some really interesting points as well about the diversity, the racial diversity in the industry as well, and how, you know, maybe there's a bit of tokenism with models mm-hmm. that are used, and the idea of like nude underwear and how it's like just nude for a white person. I know a lot of them have done like a lot of performative action around Black Lives Matter and change things then, but where do you see the industry going now? Because I know you said a lot of the lingerie makers now are women themselves, so that's awesome to kind of...
Well, that's been true since the genesis of lingerie. It's definitely a myth that it's men controlling the industry. For Victoria's Secret, there are men in charge of that brand, but Victoria's Secret is an exceptional brand in a lot of ways. You can't generalize the entire mm-hmm. industry from that one brand. But I think what you've just said goes back to my earlier point about how the industry is regressive and very slow to change. Clearly, Black women are not a new invention. We've been here for a while. For the industry to act as though we don't need new bras is a reflection on the industry and not on Black women, not a reflection on women of color. And again, it's a place where if you were to listen to Black women, if you were to listen to darker complexion women, you would know this is a need that exists because it's something we've been asking for a while. But when an industry is homogenous, when there are barriers to people of diverse backgrounds entering that industry, then that industry either doesn't know or doesn't care to expand their products. So, and we've had innovators in that field like Nubian Skin who motivated, and I'm using air quotes right now, other brands to create new tones when they saw the success of hers. And it's unfortunate that it takes something like that for brands to do the right thing as opposed to just doing it on their own. I recently did a seminar with Curve, which is the major lingerie trade show in America and kind of the organizing trade show. I don't want to say conglomerate, it's more, they run all the trade shows kind of all mm-hmm. over the world. And we did a panel about being Black in the industry and talked about how this isn't just the Instagram post. This isn't just a moment. This isn't just a thing you do for social media cookies. But like Black people are going to keep existing after people stop posting these Black squares. Like this it's isn't just a one time. Yeah, it's not just a hashtag. Like, what are you going to do in the future? Because to me, that's what counts. Not taking advantage, not doing like this little PR thing, but like, what will you do moving forward? And that's what I'm going to be paying attention to over these coming weeks, over the next year. Okay, you posted a Black square. Have you changed your advertising imagery? Are you collaborating with women of color? Not racially ambiguous women of color, but like darker skinned women of color. Or was that just a one-time thing? So that's something I'm going to keep an eye out for when it comes to this conversation, because I mean, it's so funny going back to talking about Rihanna. A lot of brands are upset at how these online companies have cornered the conversation, even though they haven't necessarily cornered market share, they've cornered the conversation, and people think these brands are very influential. I think these are a bigger account for a bigger percentage of the, I'm going to get a little bit of water. I can feel my throat starting to grate. But I talk to brands, especially heritage brands that have been around for a while, who are upset that these startups and that these new brands get so much press and so much coverage and so much credit. And I'm like, well, nobody knows you exist. So like, what are you, you don't bother with PR, you don't bother with marketing, you don't bother with advertising. You haven't bothered to expand things like your new tones. Like you don't use models of different sizes. What are you expecting when other companies are doing all that? So I have lots of thoughts. I wish more people listened to me.
No, we're listening. We're listening. No, but I think like, and your Instagram is great for calling that out. And because I think like after Black Lives Matter, someone put up, a little emoji thing, and it was just like white woman or white blonde woman, blonde, and then occasional brunette, and then it was a black square, and then one Black person, and then just went back to white blonde women after that. So it's frustrating.
So that's what I want to see. Like, are you going to work with Black people over the long? Are you going to give us the same opportunities that you give to these blonde white influencers? And are you going to do it without a Black person needing to be murdered? Because if that has to be the impetus, if that has to be the incentive, that's not okay. Like, work with Black people being preceded by a murder, which I mean, I hate that I'm having to say that, but we know that was the context for what happened.
Absolutely.
A black man was murdered. Okay, now I'm worked up.
Yeah, now I can see there's racism in the world. Now I can.
And then suddenly people feel motivated to talk about blackness and the black experience and Black Lives Matter. Oh, okay, like, yes, thank you. But we can't, these conversations can't be preceded by a murder, a brutal, torturous murder every single time for you to want to talk about this. So I think that's the other part of this conversation. I don't want to have to die for you to care about my blackness. So I think that that's also a part of it.
Yeah.
Give black people opportunities without us having to die.
Like, it's such a basic statement, but yeah, Jesus. But do you think that there's an element of tokenism as well? I know you mentioned like different skin tones as well, and like the colorism that's there between, like you said, racially ambiguous people and then maybe lighter skinned dark people. And it's rare to see really dark black people in some of these posts as well. So are there lingerie brands that are actually being properly inclusive rather than a token light skinned person, so to speak?
Yeah. Nubian Skin, I think, is very good at this. Notably, Nubian Skin is run by a black woman. Like, that's not coincidental.
There you go.
they use a range of skin tones and a range of skin tone models, and they're all gorgeous. Playful Promises has done a lot with this in terms of using models with a wide range of skin tones, including very dark skin models. Disclosure, I've had advertising partnerships with Nubian Skin in the past. Playful Promises is a current advertiser. Part of why they're advertisers, though, is because I like them a lot.
Yeah.
They are two brands that I think if we want to look at as not being tokens, or not doing tokenism, that's not the right phrasing, but
I get you.
And that are doing this consistently, like without the impetus of a murder, but where this is just a part of their brand DNA. I think those are two companies to look to, because it's not enough to create a new tone and then you model it on a white woman. Then what are you doing? There was
same stuff going on.
Yeah. I mean, this was years ago. There was a campaign that one prominent online lingerie store did to jump on this new tones for all conversation or trend that arose in the wake of Nubian Skin's debut. And it was like, we have the nude for you. And all the photos were of white women.
Oh my God. Like, it's so tone deaf.
What are you doing? Very clearly, no black people involved.
We had a campaign like that over here. And I don't know if it's the same one, but I'm pretty sure it was like eight women or something, and because of course, like, they were all cis women, and I think the one person who was slightly darker was actually just a white woman wearing quite a lot of fake tan. Like, it didn't look like there was an ethnicity difference.
Unacceptable.
And it was just, oh my God, like, just, I know, like, Ireland, there's a lot of white people in Ireland, but to be so tone deaf is just I want to say shocking, but it's not shocking, but it should be shocking.
It's a reflection, like I said, of that industry stagnation and of their unwillingness to change. And it's a reflection of who's in power in the intimate apparel industry, and it's a reflection of who has influence in the intimate apparel industry. There are intimate apparel consultants, but they're not people of color usually. They're not black women. Like, the who are other white people who don't want to rock the boat, who don't want to lose that client contract, who don't want to be to what they will call aggressive, because that's a term that's been used in my direction for speaking up. And we know that that's a racially loaded term for black women. And so when all the leaders of the industry and all the people they go to for advice are all, when they're basically the same people, and where are those outsider perspectives coming from? Where's that innovation coming from? Where's that creativity coming from? And it's coming from people whose voices are buried and who don't get the same coverage. You don't get those same startup dollars. We can't forget who is getting that capital funding from these investors. And it's not brands like Nubian Skin, which is notable. and how that leads to things just not really changing.
Yeah, very stagnant.
And then people get mad at Savage X Fenty getting pressed.
Well, even, you know, like change on a different aspect as well. You've talked about fabric being gender neutral, and I'm not sure if it was the brand you said earlier, Playful Promises, but they put up a picture of a guy. He was a white guy, but presenting.
Jake Dupree.
Yeah.
I think that's his name, Jake Dupree.
And he had like the full red set on with like stockings, suspenders, and he's quite like very masculine presenting, like very muscly and everything else.
I think they might be non-binary. I'm going to just do a quick check if that's okay.
The response was fascinating from people saying, oh my gosh, I love your brand for doing this. I'm going to buy from you now on, to other people saying, I can't believe you do this. I'm never going to buy your stuff ever again. And you're just in the middle going, fabric's gender neutral. And they were very supportive as well. And I love that approach.
Colors don't have a gender. Fabrics don't have a gender. Men should wear lace. Lace is great. I love lace. Like, why shouldn't men wear lace? And we know that for centuries, men did wear lace. Like, silk is awesome. I think it's the best thing. Why shouldn't men wear silk? So I think that's also a part of changing that conversation. And it's a good thing that brands that are very visible, especially on social media, like Playful Promises, are a part of making that change, where they're not afraid to alienate bigoted people. They're not afraid to be a brand that's kind of at the forefront, or that's leading that position, when so many other brands are so terrified of alienating people that they wind up just doing the same old thing, like you said, where they have like 8 white women in a row modeling new jeans.
Yeah, with a bit of fake tan slapped on.
Yeah, like brands I think are too afraid of alienating the wrong people, because if your brand depends on bigotry to survive, maybe your brand isn't that great.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. In this day and age, you know, yeah, definitely morals are an issue. Talk to me about giving the gift of lingerie, because that is a loaded activity for a lot of people. And the stereotype is a man buying some flammable red fabric for a woman in the wrong size, or running into a shop and he's asked how big is her chest and he just gestures vaguely
awful.
Or else like
that's
a
terrible.
bit like you, or you know, something like that.
The classic reply. So I think any gift you give your partner needs to be thoughtful and needs to come from a place of genuineness. If you have never seen your partner wear a red thong back teddy, maybe don't buy them one as a gift. If you can't even be bothered to check your partner's sizes and the lingerie drawer, that says something about how invested you actually are in this gift. If you're waiting until the last minute and running into a boutique, maybe that's not the right gift for your partner. So I think if you're going to give the gift of lingerie, you need to be prepared. First of all, you need to make sure you're close enough to this person to actually give them lingerie. Like, that's the first thing. If you feel uncomfortable about it at all, listen to that feeling and don't do it. The next thing is you need to prepare. Like, look at their sizes. Maybe ask them what they like or what they might want to try. Like, people will be very vocal if you ask about what they want. So, like, ask them. Give yourself enough time to find the thing, to buy the thing. If you go into the boutique, like, don't be weird and creepy. Like, I'm talking specifically
that's a life lesson
men.
In general, but yeah.
And keep in mind that, as I've said before, lingerie isn't just sexy stuff. Like, why not get your partner a silk caftan or a silk robe or a pair of luxurious pajamas? Like, you don't have to get them something that you see as erotic. And I think that also reaffirms, if you do something like that, that the gift is for them and not for you. Again, like, subject, not object.
That's a very good point. Yeah, it's like something you're going to see them in. So it's like, it's viewed as, a present for yourself. So it's not really very altruistic.
So get them something that will make them feel good, which might not be actually what you want to see them in. And that's okay, because it's a gift for them. So So,
I mean, yeah, no, and it makes, and I know you cover that a little bit more in your book, but yeah, it's just, I think that's just really important. And I think sizes is a delicate issue as well, especially after quarantine when we might all have, you know, need to maybe size up or something.
And that's where a looser silhouette can also help. Like, I'm wearing a caftan right now. I'm sure I have gone up a size or two, and it doesn't matter. My caftan still fits beautifully.
This is, and it's, I know my listeners can't see, but it's a gorgeous, like, red and pink and floral. It's lovely. Is that, have you seen, like, sales of caftans go up during quarantine? Because I know, like, I've lived in my pajamas mostly for quarantine.
We're definitely seeing sales of loungewear go up quite a bit.
Okay.
Sales of robes, lounge sets, pajama sets. I love a caftan. I don't know how popular they are honestly with other people, but I wear them a lot. But certainly in terms of that loungewear that can also double as something that you answer the door with.
Oh, my postman probably thinks I never get dressed.
Walk the dog.
Yeah.
We've seen in bralettes. So we've definitely seen increases in sales of those more. Whoops, my earphone just fell out. Headphone just fell out. Okay, we've definitely seen an increase in sales for those comfy, loungy, at-home items. And it'll be interesting to see if that trend persists and how long it will persist, both because we don't know how long we're going to be at home, but also because people's budgets are about to be very, very crunched. Especially here where I think the financial situation is a bit more precarious for a lot more people.
Yeah, for sure.
If how long that particular retail trend is going to last. I mean, already in terms of what department stores and what boutiques are bringing in, we're seeing them shrink their selection. Brands are dropping lines. They're not going to have them made anymore. Boutiques are dropping lines. People are dropping colors. We're going to see, I think, an investment in what we call those continuity styles, the ones that they know are going to sell and sell out. And we're also going to see brands, I think, maybe lag a little bit behind in terms of, like, trendy colors, trendy brands. The stuff that I saw in market 6 months ago is probably what we're going to see in department stores coming up when they reopen, because, I mean, that's what's out there. That's the product we have available. And so I'm telling my readers, if you see a size or a style you like, this is the time to get it, because we will probably also see some size cutbacks in relation to this will be my guess, because you're going to have boutiques and brands and department stores are going to be looking very, very closely at their numbers
over these next
few months.
Yeah.
And dropping things that do not sell and that do not make them money, which can often be very exclusionary, I think is the best way to put it. Because not every size sells equally, not every style sells equally, which can be a controversial thing to say, unfortunately, but it is true. And we're going to have brands looking very, very, very closely at what sells. So I say this anyway, but it's especially true now. If you see something you like, if something's in your size, and if you can afford it, you want to buy that thing full price, because that is what brands will be looking at over these next few months.
Okay.
If they can only buy something when it's marked down 60%, they're not going to get it again.
Okay. Wow. Oh, that's another side effect of COVID that we didn't really think of, maybe. So yeah, it's going to affect our underwear. Wow. I just had a couple of questions from some of my listeners, if that was okay, just to run through. Lou asks about stick-on bras. Are they only for B cups or smaller, or can the fuller busted people try them
as well? There are some adhesive bras that are available for larger bust sizes now. I cannot remember the name of the company right at the moment, but they are known for creating an adhesive bra that's specifically for larger busts. So they're not just for smaller busts. However, as always, you have to try them on and see if they work for you. I think that's the best answer. They're made for larger busts, so that doesn't necessarily mean they would work.
They
for
actually
you
work. Yeah, definitely. Alana asks, can you recommend any good plus size brands? And can you also advise on how to minimize the annoyance of connecting your suspender clips to stop them constantly popping off, or the hassle of trying to get the back ones on when you're getting dressed as well?
So for plus size bras, brands I'm really liking are Elomi, Playful Promises, Curvy Couture. If you are say kind of very plus size, very full busted, then Alila is a brand to check out. They've recently come out with some more fashion forward styles. They've been mostly known for their workhorse bras, and they've recently come out with more fashion forward styles that I think are good for people with particularly heavier breasts. And then the Polish brand Iwo Michelin, is a very popular one among plus size and full bust people. The range of sizes they have is simply extraordinary. So that's another brand to check out. For garters, the first thing you want to make sure is that you're wearing a 6-strap garter belt, because if you only have 4 straps, it's going to be a lot of tension on those straps. Like, garter belts you usually see in stores just have 4 very skinny straps. They're not made to do much of anything except be cute. So you want to get like a real vintage style garter belt that has the 6 straps, 6 sturdy straps. You don't want to wear your garter belt with thigh-high stockings. That is, stockings that have like the adhesive or the silicone welt, because that's too thick for the garter grip. So if you're doing that, that might be one reason why they snap off. You want the welt to not have anything else on the inside. When you're affixing the stocking, you want to make sure that you have enough of the actual stocking within the grip that it holds itself even with tension. And then when you're doing the back garter clip, raising your leg, like putting your foot on a stool or on a chair, helps to shorten that distance and make it easier to affix that back strap.
Fab. Okay. Thank you so much for answering them. I do, you know what, I could actually talk to you for ages, because it's just lovely to talk about things. I love that your philosophy is life's too short for terrible underwear, and I just think you're so right about that. So yeah, may we all buy pretty things. Where can
that
people
make you feel good?
Yes, that make you feel good. Yeah. And not just look good for others, that make you feel good about yourself.
That make you feel good.
That's awesome. Where can people find you if they want to continue the conversation?
There's my website, thelingerieaddict.com. I'm on Twitter at lingerie_addict, Instagram at thelingerieaddict. You can also join, I'm on Facebook, but I don't really like Facebook right now. You can also join my Patreon, if you want to support the work that I do. Very often the conversations I have about intimate apparel alienate brands don't really like to be called out. And so if you appreciate my point of view, if you appreciate my work, then something you can do is support my Patreon, and tiers start at $2 a month. So 50 cents.
Brilliant.
And you can buy my book.
Yeah.
Buy my book is great.
It's
because it
such
shows
a pretty
my publisher
book.
That people want to read it, and maybe they'll give me more books.
Yeah. No, it's such a pretty book. There's such gorgeous kind of like watercolor illustrations, and it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous thing. It's like a luxury treat to have, you know? So
yeah,
thank you for putting that out there in the world. Cora, thank you so, so much for talking to me. I could talk to you for hours, but yeah, maybe we'll come back and do another post-COVID lingerie talk. Would be awesome.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. This was a lot of fun. I know that like I've been very preoccupied. I live in New York City, where which was the epicenter of COVID.
No excuses needed.
So thank you for being so patient until we got out of that and life got a little more to normal.
Yeah, no.
This was great. Yeah,
priorities.
I was really happy to do it.
No, that's fine. No, thank you so much. And thank you so much for my listeners for tuning in today. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I'm pleased to say that I am actually giving away a copy of Cora's book, because why not treat yourself to this gorgeous luxury item? If you pop over to the Instagram for the podcast, which is GlowS Podcast, you can find out how to win yourself this gorgeous item over there. If you want to follow us over on Twitter, it's the same handle, it's GlowS Podcast. And if you really like us, please do rate and review on Apple Podcasts. If you're on Spotify, please do follow. And if you want to contribute to the bills and you really want to say thanks that way, you can pop over to Patreon, and that's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye.